solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Hello, listeners. Hope you're having a great start to 2024. Welcome back to the Play to Potential podcast. I guess this is that time of the year when your New Year resolutions and goals for 2024 meet the rough and tumble of daily life. And if your experience is anything like mine, you would notice that very often life takes over and these lists often go to the background only to reappear around Christmas later in the year. Hence, in this episode, we've chosen to connect the dots around habits. I hope you will find the episode relevant and timely. If you're new to the podcast, I should mention that we are going through a phase where we are pausing, collecting the dots, and we are focusing on connecting them. I hope you find these compilations helpful. Needless to say, in a few months, we will come back to having new guests and adding to our library. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman. I'm based in Mumbai, and my mission is to help growth-minded individuals and organizations play to their unique potential. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a sounding board to leaders. However, I realize that my bandwidth is finite, and there are only so many people I can work with at one point in time. Hopefully, this content can make a difference to a wider set of people who are keen on playing to their respective potential. To know more, you can visit www.playtopotential.com. That's PlayToPotential.com. We started this podcast series in 2016, way back when podcasting was not even a thing. Now, as you would know, there are thousands of podcasts out there. If you are new to our podcast series, I should mention that we are not a volume player. However, we do strive to hold the bar high on signal-to-noise ratio, even if it means reducing our frequency. We also realize that there are several things screaming for your attention on a day-to-day basis. So if we don't have anything meaningful to say, we prefer to stay silent than putting something out there just because we want to maintain a certain arbitrary frequency. Let's dive into the topic for this episode, habits. I wanted to take the opportunity to share a few things I've learned from the podcast over the years and some of my work with leaders. Some of the thinkers we will learn from in this episode include James Clear, author of Atomic Habits, BJ Fogg, director of the Behavior Design Lab in Stanford and author of Tiny Habits, Katie Milkman, professor at Wharton, author of How to Change, and co-founder of Behavior Change for Good Initiative. Marshall Goldsmith, an accomplished coach and an author. Ayelet Fishback, professor of behavioral science at University of Chicago. And Devdutt Patnaik, an experienced mythologist. Hope you enjoy us connecting the dots across the insights from them, and hope this will help you convert the New Year resolutions into meaningful outcomes. Without further ado, let's dive in. The first piece I wanted to share on this topic comes from James Clear, author of Atomic Habits. Turns out that The Atomic Habits was the number one best-selling book on Amazon in 2021 and once again in 2023. Clearly, it's a well-written book, but I guess it also points to the crying need that people have for building habits. When I spoke to him on the Play to Potential podcast, I really loved what he said about systems versus goals.
That phrase, we do not rise to the level of our goals, we fall to the level of our systems. What I'm really trying to get at with that is the distinction between our desired outcomes and our daily habits. Because a lot of the time, whether it's an individual or an organization that I work with, they, when they want to change their behavior, they often start by trying to set a larger goal. let's, you know, double revenue this quarter, or I want to lose a certain amount of weight in the next 3 months, or whatever it is. And we think, well, if I just have bigger goals, if I try to take massive action, then I'll get these massive results. But the truth is, the goal is actually the easy part. And it's also fairly common among people in your particular industry to have the same goals. You know, like if 100 people apply for a job, presumably every candidate has the goal of getting the job. Or if 30 teams compete in the league for the same championship, presumably every team has the goal of winning the championship. And so if the winners and the losers in that domain have the same goals, the goal cannot be the thing that makes the difference. And that doesn't mean that goals are useless. Goals can be useful for setting a sense of direction, developing clarity, understanding where you want to focus. But once you understand that, once you understand where you want to allocate your attention and energy, it's useful to sort of put the goal on the shelf, philosophically speaking, and focus almost exclusively on the system. And I would define the system as the collection of daily habits that you follow and take you toward a particular goal. So ultimately, what we're looking for, of course, is to align the desired outcome, the goal, with your daily habits, the system. But whether you have the goal or not, and this is why I think it's so useful to focus on the system, your habits will carry you to a place whether you want them to or not.
When I look at the language around New Year resolutions, very often it's about the goals, the mountains we want to climb, rather than the fitness we need to build to be able to climb the mountains. Whether it's individuals or companies, I guess we don't rise to the level of our goals. We fall to the level of our systems. The real question to ask, I guess, is not the loftiness of the goals, but the sustainability and the robustness of the baby steps you're beginning to take in the various things you want to get done this year. Along the way, we will revisit the depth of meaning behind baby steps in a few minutes. But for now, all I want to state is that pay attention to the process as much as the outcome you seek. Before we go any further, let's understand the theory behind habits a little better. Let's now turn to BJ Fogg of Stanford. His early years were working with tech companies to create products that grab people's attention and influence their behavior. Now, he's moved to the other side to help people to drive positive behavioral change. His book Tiny Habits is a great read on the topic. I really love the way he gives a theoretical construct to how we build habits. He starts with talking about MAP, motivation, ability, and prompt.
In the behavior model, you have motivation, ability, and prompt. So let's talk about just motivation and ability. Those two components work like teammates. And if the motivation is really high for a behavior, you can do hard behaviors. But if the motivation's really low, you can't do hard behaviors. Therefore, it has to be really easy. Or in other words, you have to have high ability to do the behavior. So one of the breakthroughs in that model is the understanding that motivation and ability can compensate for each other. So it's a compensatory relationship, and talking about them as teammates is a little more straightforward. Let's say you're playing volleyball and there's two people on a team. If your teammate's really strong, you can be weak and you can still win. You both can be strong, but you both can't be weak, otherwise you won't win. So if motivation's low and it's hard to do, then despite how many times you're prompted, you won't do the behavior. So there is a curve that I call the action line on a landscape, that the visual version of the model. And if you're above that line, so if motivation is high and ability is high enough, you're above the line, you will do the behavior when prompted. If either one is zero, if you have no motivation or you have no ability, then of course you won't do the behavior when prompted. And if they're both relatively low, you're probably below the action line. And even when prompted, you don't do the behavior. So what's really exciting, I think, I mean, it looks so simple graphically, but the implications are enormous. It helps you understand that in order to do hard things, you have to have high motivation. But then when you look at the reality of being a human being, you don't always have high motivation. So that means to be consistent in doing any behavior, It needs to be easy to do. And this was the insight that led to Tiny Habits. If the habit, the new habit, is really easy to do, then you don't need high levels of motivation. Your motivation can sag and it can be pretty low, and you'll still do the behavior when prompted. So that's that Tiny Habits method came from me looking at my own model and seeing that, you know, acknowledging that motivation goes up and down over time. We don't have lots of control over levels of motivation, but we can make things easier to do. In fact, let's make them so easy to do that the motivation needed is minuscule. And that's really what Tiny Habits is about. It's about consistency of doing the habit, not the size or the difficulty of the habit.
While he speaks about motivation and ability here, he calls prompts as a low-hanging fruit of habit formation.
So a prompt is anything that reminds you or cues you or triggers you to do a behavior. I'm using all of those as synonyms. It's the thing that says, do this now. Mm-hmm. And there are various sources. There's basically three categories of prompts. And in Tiny Habits, the category we use is you use your existing routine to be the prompt. And that's different, and that's a breakthrough. And that means you don't use the other category, what I call context prompts, which is post-its, alarms, other people, notifications, all those things that annoy us. You don't use that in the Tiny Habits method. Instead, you use something that's natural, something that's already built into your life, an existing routine, and then you anchor your new habit to that existing routine. And so it's, and that insight didn't come to me for a while later. So I knew motivation, ability, how they work together. And I knew that making something super simple would let you be consistent in creating a habit. But then it was like, how do you prompt it? How do you prompt it? And then that just happened, like a lot of breakthroughs. You know, there's literally was getting out of the shower and it's like, oh my gosh, it's after. You figure out what this comes after and you use the preceding behavior to remind you of the next thing, this new habit that you want. And so then it all clicked, and then I knew I had all the pieces in place, because it always comes back to just motivation, ability, prompt. And then I knew I had, here's this breakthrough way of habits where you're hacking three things. One, you're making the behavior super tiny, so you don't need much motivation. Two, you are prompting it through something you already do, an existing routine that we call an anchor in Tiny Habits. And then three, you manipulate your emotion so your brain takes notice and goes, whoa, that feels good. I want to do that again in the future. And so you don't leave that to chance. You deliberately celebrate and cause that emotion to fire off, which then changes the regulation of dopamine in the brain.
While MAP is a useful construct to understand how there's a trade-off between ability and motivation and how we need a prompt to trigger a habit, BJ Fogg goes on to talk about the ABC of habit building, which I found interesting in its construct.
So the ABC of Tiny Habits is kind of an accident that it's ABC. That was not intentional. It just happened. Mm-hmm. But A stands for the anchor. So that's the thing you already do. It's solid and reliable in your life. The anchor then reminds you to do the new habit. So the B is the behavior. What's the tiny behavior? So brushing might be your anchor. You always brush. And let's say you don't have the habit of flossing. So flossing is what then comes right after brushing. So brushing becomes the reminder to floss. And that's how you do it in the Tiny Habits method. You don't put up post-its. You don't use alarms. You use an existing routine. In Tiny Habits, we call it an anchor to be the reminder for the new habit. And you don't make the habit big. You make it super tiny. So if you want to floss, perhaps it's just floss one tooth. If you want to meditate, maybe it's just three breaths. So you just scale it back so tiny. And the C part stands for celebration. And that is a technique to cause a positive emotion inside yourself, an instant positive emotion. And it's that emotion that wires the habit in. So if I'm flossing one tooth, and if I go, way to go, BJ, I look in the mirror and I smile at myself, and I feel a positive emotion, what I'm doing with that emotion, with that hack, like, way to go, BJ, I am wiring that habit into my brain. So it's a new technique. It's a new way of looking at habits. It's really effective if you can find the authentic celebration and you can wire in habits very quickly by doing it. So it's not about repetition. It's about the emotion that you feel while you're doing the new behavior. That's what causes, if it's a positive emotion, that's what causes the habit to form.
I was particularly intrigued by the celebration element of wiring a habit. I noticed that we all do a good job of celebrating something small that our child does, or even our colleague does. But sometimes we don't do enough to acknowledge to ourselves. BJ calls celebration the reinforcement or the locking mechanism for habits.
Yeah, so rewards is one of those words that the way we use it in English today is ambiguous. And reward is the right technical term. However, many people use it in a way that's not accurate. Too often when people say, oh, I'm going to go to the gym and then I'm going to reward myself by, you know, going and watching a movie. Well, I would call that a prize or an incentive. It's not a reward. Reward is the thing that happens as you do the behavior or immediately after. And your brain associates the reward with the habit you just did. And so because it's a problematic word, I've decided not to use that word. Again, it's ambiguous. And if you have an ambiguous word, then it's not a very good technical term. So instead, I talk about celebration as a technique for creating a positive emotion. So it's serving the function of a reward in the technical sense of things. But I try not to use that word because too often people think of a reward as like a prize they'll get at the end of 30 days. So I'll, you know, eat a vegetable every day and at the end of 30 days, I'll get my reward. Well, that doesn't wire in the habit. That's serving as an incentive to motivate you, but it doesn't serve to wire in the habit. So really what you're shooting for to wire in the habit is to cause a positive emotion inside yourself. Now, sometimes these will happen naturally. When you look at any app or technology that you love and you use on a daily basis, I would wager a lot of money that the first time you use that app or that technology, it made you feel very successful. It made you feel like you had superpowers, like, oh my gosh, I can do so much. I'm so capable with this. And that's what helped wire that in as a habit, was that sense of success. I'm achieving something important. And so that will happen naturally with, oh, lots of things. But for new habits, that doesn't always happen naturally. The fact that you're wiping the kitchen counter doesn't make you go, oh, I'm so great, you know, naturally. So you hack that emotion by going, look at the counter, I'm so awesome. You know, so you deliberately cause that emotion to fire off. And so celebration is the term that we decided to use for causing that emotion. And we looked at other terms like self-cheer. That was one we looked at, or just plain cheer, you know, cheer yourself, cheer for yourself. I could have also picked like reinforce, self-reinforcement. Mm-hmm. As the word, but self-reinforcement has already been used in the 70s to mean something, and it's something quite a bit different. So I couldn't use the term self-reinforcement, but that's what you're doing with celebration. You're reinforcing, you're making that habit stronger, and you're doing it deliberately. So celebration is the technique to self-reinforce.
While celebration is one way to reinforce, the other piece worth bringing in here is how we can build resilience in how we develop a habit. Turns out, there's something we can learn from babies and how they take their baby steps. Let's hear from Tom Vanderbilt, author of the book Beginners. Inspired by his young daughter's insatiable curiosity, Tom Vanderbilt embarks on a year-long quest for learning, purely for the sake of learning. He picks five things: singing, chess, surfing, drawing, and my personal favorite, ball juggling. In this piece, Tom speaks about how kids learn and how they keep changing the nature of experiments they do to make the learning less brittle. He speaks about his insights from the Infant Action Lab in New York University, where he saw how children experiment their way into learning and what we can learn from that.
So I went to New York University, they have something called the Infant Action Lab, and one of the things they study quite a bit is how babies learn to move. And there's sort of a process they go through where they will first just try to sit up a little bit, then they might start crawling, doing these various half, you know, crawling. Then they'll try to make this move toward walking. And, you know, it's very interesting in terms of a learning process because they, you know, sort of violate a lot of the things you hear about. You know, they don't really have a specific timetable in mind or a goal. When researchers have tried to figure out where babies are even walking to, they really can't identify. They seem to be just be walking for the sheer pleasure of walking and to sort of practice it in a sense, because and there's even some question as why babies learn to walk when they can really often get around pretty well by crawling. And in a sense, learning to walk provides that much more learning opportunity because you can see more of the world, you can reach other destinations, you can interact more directly with a caregiver. So I almost think there's sort of a larger hunger for learning there going on. And importantly, you know, that we don't give babies drills in how to walk or exercises. We just sort of leave them in a room and in the house and they try it on their own. And, you know, through this process of just simply trying, and there are a lot of, speaking of 10,000 hours, I mean, it takes, you know, 5 years or so to become a proficient walker. So there's clearly a lot of work that goes on, even though we've sort of forgotten about that. But as part of that, there's an immense failure rate. You know, the researchers I spoke to had filmed babies, you know, falling 30 or 40 or even up to 70 times in an hour while trying to walk. And then they would simply shrug it off and get up and start walking again. And so there's something about, you know, and their whole practice of learning is very sort of seems very random and playful and experimental. And they're never really trying the same thing twice, because that wouldn't be a good way to learn for them, because walking is often not the same thing moving around. And there's a famous Russian movement scientist named Nikolai Bernstein who called it repetition without repetition. And this means when you're trying to solve something like walking or how to juggle, you don't simply want to do the same thing all the time, because that is a very brittle practice. You might find out the way to juggle three balls perfectly if they always land perfectly in your hands. But the minute there's a little bit of variation, as there usually is, if you've stuck too closely to one drill, you know, you won't have the flexibility to try to solve that problem in a new way. So that's just, you know, I think babies just have this, and children in general, just there's a lot we can sort of take on about their learning process that would bring us benefits. Obviously, we know how to walk, but there's many other things that we can, you know, sort of take that spirit. And you know, another element there would be just a lack of pressure. Certainly, parents are often eager for their children to start walking as soon as possible, but you know, babies aren't really aware of that. They're not aware of I must learn this thing, or oh, I'm falling so much, I'm terrible, I'm embarrassed. They have none of that. They simply have the freedom to learn in a very sort of fun, low pressure environment, which adults often do not have.
Fascinating. You know, juggling, I was particularly curious about your piece on juggling, because when I was in the UK about a couple of decades back in London, mm-hmm. I remember going to a juggling show in Covent Garden in central London. And I remember mm-hmm. walking up to one of the jugglers saying, I want to learn juggling. And he told me, why don't you just come to my shop in Camden Town, which is one of the neighborhoods where, you know, generally you have every other person has a piercing in some part of the body. It's sort of where,
yes,
you know, all kinds of people, interesting people hang out. And one of the early lessons that the guy gave me was, when you're juggling, just ensure you have a different background. You know, don't do it against a plain wall. You know, one day do it against the sun, one day do it against a colored wall. Then you'll get comfortable spotting the balls amidst chaos. If you sort of learn it in a pure environment against a plain white wall, one day somebody might ask you to perform in front of a crowd of 10, and you won't be able to spot the ball because you're so used to seeing it against a white background. So it's just a simple tip, but now when I go back to what you just said about, you know, just mixing up things a little bit, I go back to that piece of advice.
No, yeah, it's a great point and something that I incorporated as well, and other things as well. You know, if you always began with your dominant hand, will sometimes switch up to your right hand, and you know, and what you're saying can help you, I think, push through the plateaus that do come along in trying to learn something. I mean, because the learning curve is a sort of a capricious beast. There's very rapid progress in the beginning often, but then you sort of hit this first plateau and the brain is essentially sort of run out of solutions to how to get to the next step. So I think part of a way to kickstart those solutions is like you say, to change the environment, change the things that you're throwing, change the way you're throwing them, change the speed at which you're throwing them. That's another tip I was given. Don't often throw at the same speed or the same height. Just practice solving the problem in as many different ways as you can, rather than simply coming up with this one perfect solution, because the world is very rarely so perfect.
This is a good segue into something I learned from Katie Milkman. Katie is a professor at Wharton, the author of How to Change, and co-founder of Behavior Change for Good Initiative. She also hosts a popular podcast titled Choiceology, where she discusses how we can all make better decisions. Picking up on what Tom Vanderbilt says about baby steps, Katie has a similar point about how we practice. She says that it's better for us to be a flexible Fernando than a robust Rachel when it comes to practice.
The age-old wisdom on habits is that you want to repeat the same behavior in a really consistent way. Sort of, you need to find a cue, like a time of day or a location, where you always perform this behavior, and as much consistency as you can create around its performance, the better. Then you perform the behavior, you reward it, and you repeat. And the more often you do that, the stronger a routine or a habit you'll build. And I did this study that I thought would get at that. It was a study where we were trying to build exercise habits actually among Google employees, about 2,500 of them who wanted to create habits around the start of a new year, fresh start effect. And we either coached them to engage in the behavior, in this case, exercise, and we paid them to do it. We rewarded them for it, either in a really consistent way, like same time of day whenever they did it, or we encouraged more variety in the way that they engaged in the behavior. So over the course of a month, some people basically are coached to go to the gym always at the same time and ended up making about 85% of their workouts at a consistent time that they had planned in advance, let's say 7 a.m. If, you know, for a person in our example was their ideal time, they 85% of their workouts over the course of this month are at 7 a.m. then. And another group of people also picked their ideal time, but they're encouraged to go whenever they want. And as a result, about half of their gym visits end up being at their ideal time, let's say 7 a.m. The other half are at other times. So the question we were interested in is, this month ends, we've sort of helped people train up a habit, or we tried to, but whose habit will be stickier? If both groups go at the same rate, will it be the people who were mostly visiting the gym at the same time, or people who had more variety in when they did it? We expected actually it would be better to have more consistency, that would build a more consistent habit. But when we analyzed the data, what we found is we were wrong. So two people, they've gone to the gym in equal frequency for a month, but in different patterns. One is going at the same time all the time, the other's going all over the place, you know, at different times. We see the person who has more variety ends up going more after this month ends. And the reason is really simple, it turns out, in our data. The people who had been going really at the same time over and over again had formed a really rigid routine. So they were actually a little bit more likely to go at their 7 a.m. gym time, the time that was best for them on average, at the end of this period. So after they had formed a habit around that. But if they didn't go then, they didn't go at all. So, you know, something comes up. I miss my 7 a.m. workout. I throw up my hands. I can't make it. I miss my 7 a.m. workout. That's it. The people who had been more flexible in when they went to the gym, sometimes they went at 7, sometimes they went at 5. They go a little bit less at 7 a.m., right, at their usual time after this sort of month-long habit building period ends. But if they miss their 7 a.m. workout, they still get to the gym. So they go at noon or they go at 5. And net-net, they actually have built a more robust habit. So this was really surprising to us. What we were expecting is that consistency that would build habit. And what we found is it was actually rigidity that we were building, and that flexibility proved so important to getting the thing done that you're trying to do on a regular basis, and that we need to have flexible habits.
Flexible Fernando and robust Rachel are her terms. But if you think there's a gender bias here, we could say it's better to be a flexible Fiona than a robust Richard. But I hope you get the broader point that's being made here. To share a personal example, I noticed that when I practice the guitar, I sometimes practice a certain melody on the acoustic guitar and then on the electric guitar. Each one has a slightly different dimension, tension in the strings, and the layout. I noticed that when I practice across both these, I end up finding it easy to play on a friend's instrument than if I've just practiced it on one guitar. The variation in the topography of these two instruments seems to help in building flexibility in the muscle memory. Similarly, earlier I had a fixed schedule for my gym sessions, and I realized that whenever I traveled on those days, I missed the slot. Now, I have a broad understanding with my trainer that we will do 2 days a week. But which 2 days depends on my schedule. I notice that I end up doing more sessions with this approach than a rigid approach. Both these are experiments I have tried after the conversation with Katie Milkman, and personally, I found it very helpful. While flexibility is one way that helps in building habits that stick, another approach is having somebody hold you accountable. There are many ways in which we can have people hold us accountable. Marshall Goldsmith, one of the leading coaches in the world, speaks about an approach that he adopts for himself.
I'm going to give you a technique now that takes 3 minutes a day, costs you nothing. It'll help you get better at almost anything and will stick if you do it. Now, some people are thinking 3 minutes a day, it costs nothing, help me get better at almost anything. It sounds ridiculous, too good to be true. Half the people start doing this quit in 2 weeks. We'll see how you do. 2 weeks, people quit. It's called the daily question process. Okay. Okay, get together a spreadsheet. On one column, write down a series of questions representing anything in your life you want to get better at. Friends, family, health, work, whatever. Every question is answered with yes, no, or number. 7 boxes across, fill it out every day. At the end of the week, you get a report card. I'm going to warn your listeners in advance that report card at the end of the week may not be as beautiful as a corporate values plaque you see up on the wall. See, in my glowing introduction, you mentioned a lot of good things about me. One thing you left out, I have an incredible skill you left out. That's the ability to screw something up almost every day. Yeah, screw something up almost every day. Well, you do this process every day, you get to look at it. Now, I have someone call me on the phone every day to make sure I do this, every day. Somebody asked me, well, why do you have someone call you on the phone? Don't you know the theory about how to change behavior? I wrote the theory about how to change behavior. That's why someone called me on the phone. My name is Marshall Goldsmith. I got ranked number one coach and leadership thinker in the world for years. I have someone call me on the phone every day just to listen to me read questions I wrote and provide answers I wrote every day. Why? My name is Marshall Goldsmith. I'm too cowardly and too undisciplined to do any of this stuff by myself. I need help. And you know what? It's okay. It's okay. We all need help. You do what I just told you. You'll get better at almost anything. Let me tell you something. You don't have the guts to do this. You're probably too cowardly and undisciplined as me. You know why we don't do this? It's hard to do. It's incredibly hard to do. It takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of humility. It takes discipline. It's humbling to look in the mirror every day. Yeah, it's humbling. It's not humbling to talk about values and change and transition and blah, blah, blah. Talk. That's not humbling. What's humbling is when somebody asks you, what are you the world's expert at? And you can't even give him an answer. That's humbling. That's not talk. You see, there's a big gap between talk and live. Talk is easy. Live is hard. Almost all leadership development is talk. Buzzwords. As if somehow a better buzzword is going to help people change. Nobody gets better because of buzzwords. You actually have to work. And it's hard. If it were easy, I would not have someone call me on the phone every day. Now, there's a great book called The Checklist Manifesto, published by Dr. Atul Gawande from Harvard Medical School. If the nurse asks the doctor a series of questions before in the surgery, the odds on unneeded infection plummet, and the death rates cut by 2/3. The majority of hospitals in the world do not allow the nurse to ask the doctor the questions. And what's the first question? Did you wash your hands? Why? Ego. Why won't the doctor have the nurse ask the question? Ego. They're ashamed. They are ashamed to admit they need help. They're embarrassed to admit they need help. Yet, how do you get people to stick with it? It's hard. It's not easy. They have to work. They have to work over and over. And by the way, it's like getting in shape. You say, well, why don't they stay in shape after they get in shape? It's like, once I get in shape, I can quit now. I'll be in shape for eternity. That's not the way it happens. No, you have to keep doing it for life.
I must confess that I have toyed with this idea for myself, but somehow never got myself to doing it. Wherever I'm in doubt of following through, I try and share it widely as much as I can, so that the people around me can hold me accountable, whether it's my family, my colleagues, or my podcast listeners. I find that as a useful disciplining mechanism. I guess we all need to find the mechanism that works for us. We also need to be mindful of the language we use to track our progress, especially when we are starting something new. Do we look at the glass half full or half empty? Professor Ayelet Fishback at the University of Chicago, and the author of the book Get It Done, has an interesting perspective here.
You can always monitor progress in terms of what you achieved or in terms of what you still need to achieve. You can look at your job and say, here's what I achieved, here's what's still ahead of me. You can look at, loyalty program that you enrolled in and look at the rewards that you already collected or the rewards that are still ahead of you. Turn out that it's really important for motivation, that how you monitor your progress will impact your motivation. Specifically, when you look back, that helps you establish your commitment. If you look back and you say, well, I've already done so much at my job, then you feel more committed. You feel that what you do is more valuable. You feel more able. Okay? Your past actions suggest to you that you can do it very well. And so looking back is very useful when we are unsure about our commitment, when we doubt whether this is something that's useful or something that I can do. Look back at what you already did and you discover that, yes, you can do it. You already did some of it. Okay? You're capable. Looking ahead is motivating when it encourages progress, when it highlights how far are we from the goal in a way that leads us to close the gap. When we think about this discrepancy, like I wanted to be somewhere and I'm a little bit away from it, I will increase my effort to get there. The metaphor that we sometimes use is the metaphor of the thermostat, okay? The thermostat senses that the room is not warm enough. So, you know, the engine gets into action to get the temperature higher. And our motivation system sometimes does the same. Now, the question is when, right? When should I look back? Of ahead. Well, if you're uncommitted, you want to look back. Okay. If you're already committed, you already know that something is important, then you want to look ahead at what is missing. To give you an example, we did the study with students that were studying for either an exam that was not very important for them, so they were not really sure about their commitment, or an exam that was absolutely important, that was part of their major. turned out that for the unimportant exam, directing students to think about the materials that they've already covered increased their commitment. For the important exam, directing their attention to the materials that they have not yet covered increased their motivation. Okay, thinking about what they still need to study increased their motivation to study.
While we are sharing this podcast episode in the context of the start of a new year, I've come to realize that we don't have to wait for the turn of the calendar year for embarking on these kinds of habit-forming or system-building exercises. Katie Milkman says that if we look hard enough, we find enough opportunities for a fresh start all around.
And Jason, Hengchen, and I started thinking about what we knew already and what we could learn about when the ideal time is to encourage change and when are people most motivated just naturally to change in their own lives. What we found is that there are moments, this won't surprise you at all, that feel more like fresh starts to people. And the one that we're all familiar with already is New Year's, right? This is a moment when around the world, people are setting resolutions at a higher rate than usual, trying to pursue goals at a higher rate than usual, and it feels like a fresh start. The psychology of New Year's is actually turns out to be familiar and extend to many other moments. But the psychology of New Year's is you can say sort of, well, that was the old me last year. The old me couldn't achieve this, you know, right? The old me tried to quit smoking and failed, but that was a whole different person. The new me in the new year can do it. And you feel this dissociation from your past failures and this renewed optimism as you open a new chapter in life. What we found is that New Year's is actually just one moment that has that new chapter, fresh start feeling. There are lots of other moments on the calendar and in life when we also feel we're turning a page and can get that same dissociation from past failures and motivation and also the likelihood that we might actually step back and think big picture about our lives is greater. So some of those moments include, according to our research, the start of a new week or a new month, the celebration of holidays that feel like fresh starts in our culture, the celebration of birthdays. And of course, there's other research looking not only at these sort of psychological or temporal markers that give us the sense of a clean slate and a fresh start, but if you physically change environments, that has not only psychological appeal and helps you, but it can literally disrupt routines in a way that's helpful as well. So we've shown people are more likely at these temporal landmarks, we call them, or new beginnings, to do things like visit the gym or set goals on popular goal setting websites online about everything from their finances to their health to their education. And if you encourage people to make a change at those moments, a moment that has a label on it, like, hey, you know, want to make a change on the first day of spring or after your next birthday, it turns out that's more attractive. People are more likely to do things like start saving in a retirement account when you invite them to, or just pursue goals beginning at those times when you give them those labels. Then if you invite them to save at an identical moment or change at an identical moment, but don't even point out that it corresponds with the first day of spring or a birthday. So that was a really, I'd say, exciting line of research, and it points to the power of taking advantage of these moments in our lives if we want to make a change, and encouraging others to make changes and providing with the resources they need to make changes at those moments when we feel like we have a fresh start and are therefore more naturally inclined to change.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually referred to Google creating something called a moments engine and using that to nudge behavior. Any nuance there in terms of how the moments engine works?
Yeah, this was really something exciting that I learned about when I called Prasad up after, you know, it had been a while since I'd made this visit to Google. And I said, hey, Prasad, I'm writing this book. And, you know, thank you again for this amazing conversation, which spurred all this research, which he, of course, knew about because I'd been sharing with him over the years what we'd found. And I said, has Google done anything or used this in any way? I'm curious. And he said, yeah, actually, we created this moments engine that we use to nudge employees towards making different decisions or, you know, adopting different programs at moments that are appropriate and feel like fresh starts to them. So I thought that was really exciting. I honestly wouldn't have ever learned about it potentially if I hadn't been writing this book and reaching back out to him to ask, you know, what he was up to, how things were going at Google, if they'd ever done anything with that old fresh start research I shared with them based on his question. So it was really exciting to hear they've done that. And I know another organization, Humu, which is actually a spinoff from Google. It's an HR organization, but they've used machine learning to sort of digitize HR programs, and then they help companies manage people more effectively.
That's the one headed by Laszlo Bock.
You got it. You got it. And Laszlo was at Google at the time when I was doing this work. I'm now an advisor at Humu, and Laszlo has told me they also use in their algorithms fresh start moments as points in time when they try to nudge certain behavior change. So I know at least two organizations that have used this in their algorithms to try to promote positive change. And I hope there will be many more if there aren't already.
Talking about fresh start, I remember working with a leader who had transitioned from being CEO of one of the subsidiaries of GE to heading a JV for an Indian family-owned professional organization. He had taken charge during the peak of COVID and was finding his way through the situation. One of the challenges of leading during the COVID times was that he did not have an opportunity to build deep, meaningful relationships with the functional leaders in the corporate headquarters, his peers in a way. They were a set of stakeholders that had a key role to play in his success in the group. In transitions, what happens is that you get the first 1 to 3 month honeymoon window where you can have these ice-breaking conversations to get to know people. After that, people find it awkward to have this get-to-know conversations as the pressure of performance starts mounting. But in this instance, as the world opened up post-COVID about 12 months after he started, it presented a fresh start opportunity. I nudged the leader to make a renewed attempt at getting to know the stakeholders without the awkwardness associated with it. I guess if we look around enough, I do truly believe that there are many opportunities for us to leverage events happening around us to go for a fresh start. While we've been speaking about building new habits, it's worth briefly talking about how we get rid of undesirable habits. It might be smoking, excessive drinking, overeating, or any such habit that's not serving us well. One of the things I love about having embarked on this podcast journey is the nuance with which some of the people use language. BJ Fogg of Stanford, for instance, says that we should think of disentangling bad habits, not breaking them.
The language around behavior change has held us back. And this word, break bad habits, has been one of the problems. Because break implies that if you put a lot of force in at one moment, like breaking a stick, it'll be done. So a lot of force, a lot of energy in one moment is how you solve it. That's not how these kinds of habits get solved. It's not about a one-time thing that gets people to stop gambling or stop drinking or stop gaming or whatever the addiction is or whatever the bad habit is. So I am proposing and explaining how a better word is untangle unwanted habits. And that then implies a process. Just like if you think of your phone headset all tangled up, wow, it looks overwhelming. You're not going to solve it just by yanking on it in one moment. But you know that if you take the easiest tangle, not the hardest, and undo that, and then go to the next easiest one, that you'll get there. Same thing with these things that we call bad habits. They tend to be things, snacking is a pretty easy example to use. So if you have you consider a bad habit of, you know, eating bad foods as a snack, it's not just one thing. It's probably there's a snack in the morning, there's a snack at lunch, snack driving home, snack in the evening, snack at 3 a.m. So it's a tangle that we call a habit, but really it's all these habits connected together. And so you take the easiest snacking habit to stop, the easiest one, not the hardest one, and you design that out of your life. And then you go to the next one and the next one. And so I think untangling really sets the expectation much better that it's a process and really maps very well to how you look at a tangled rope or a phone headset. at first it's overwhelming and you're like, oh my gosh. But then as you get started, you see it starts resolving, and then pretty soon it comes completely clear. It untangles. And so I think that's right on for how many of these unwanted habits work.
I think there's something to be said about setting the right defaults and changing the environment around us when we are trying to disentangle undesirable habits. For instance, I remember there was a phase where I felt I was using my mobile phone for longer than I needed to. Of the various things I tried, what helped me the most was turning the phone into a monochrome mode. That default setting made it much less attractive for me to stare into the phone, and the red notifications that would come on the top right stopped grabbing my attention, and slowly my mobile phone usage came down. We are coming to the end of the episode. Just a quick look at a couple of things before we wrap up. While this podcast is themed around building new positive habits and moving away from negative ones, there's a nuance here that's worth pointing out. Habits can sometimes also indicate that you're being conditioned like a Pavlovian dog, and that can be counterproductive at times. This came up in my conversation with the reputed mythologist Devdutt Patnaik.
See, this concept of habits is a Western idea. The habit is a bad word in Indian philosophy. It's a bad word. Therefore, you're continuous. Another word for habit is conditioned. I'm conditioned to do it. Conditioning, that's a Pavlovian response, right? A dog has a habit of salivating whenever the bell rings. And the West has made it a virtue. Action without thought is habit. Repetitive action without thought is habit. And if you look at the many of the cultures in the West, they are like domesticated animals. At a particular time, they'll get up and run. At a particular time, they'll get up. So there is, it's this kind of a, they are on a treadmill all the time. And this is seen as virtue. You know, driving in the car with a coffee in your hand. Nobody sees in America that this is tragedy. It's a tragedy. You can't enjoy your coffee. You can't enjoy your drive. You have glamorized slavery. You have glamorized slavery. And nobody sees it because you're all the Gurujis, they have white coats with their chin, the fist on the chin photographs, you know, those photographs that you see, are telling you, and therefore it must be right. Nobody's questioning, what is the habit? And habit has been somehow projected as a good thing. Indian thought is all about awareness. It's all about awareness. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you not doing what you're not doing? And once you're aware, then you realize what is of value to you and what is not of value to you. So you are not in now habit, the breaking habits becomes difficult. And then breaking habit becomes, there are good habits, there are bad habits. Habits are good and bad depending on context. You know, so you will find people behaving, that's why I always find, you know, when expats come to India, they have a tough time because the habit is suddenly in the new context, they don't know. Because, oh my God, there's no place to run. There's no place to, oh my God, they don't have this thing. Because the habit, right, they become the animal. You have become like an animal. And habit really goes to the lower part of your brain, not the upper part of your brain. And your habit is about avoiding life. You do habits like, it's an addiction.
It's like autopilot.
It's an autopilot. No, and it's addictive. Like, I have a habit of writing. But it's an addiction. If I don't write, I get withdrawal symptoms. Which means I've trained my body to be in pain when I don't do it. And to get pleasure when I do it. And I'm not aware of it. I'm just doing it mechanically. So we are an awareness culture. Awareness, 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 not habit culture.
People often ask me, you've been doing this podcast for 5 to 6 years now, and you've spoken to 100 plus people. What have you learned from it? For me, personally, this would be one of the top 3 things that has made a difference to me. The emphasis on awareness and tuning into how life is evolving rather than blindly being a slave to the habits. That brings us to the question, so how do you really walk the tightrope between being aware and building habits? And this is where we turn to James Clear, where we started this episode. In his book Atomic Habits, he takes us to an interesting practice in Japanese railway stations.
Yeah, so the technical definition of a habit is a behavior that has been repeated enough times to be more or less automatic. So things that you can do without thinking, brushing your teeth, tying your shoes, etc. But in the beginning, when you're building a new habit, it does not occupy that automatic space. It's a very effortful, conscious thing. And so the problem is that because it's not our automatic response, the moment of action often passes us by. And that's for building a good habit. For changing our current habits, however, they do occupy that automatic space. There's something that we do. There's something that we do without even thinking about it a lot of the time. And because they are so automatic, we often perform them without even realizing it. We're done with the action before we even notice that we did that. And so there's this method, which is called pointing and calling, that I think helps raise our level of awareness about our current habits. And once we become aware of our habits, then we can change them. Then we can start to more meaningfully adjust them. So the story, and I actually saw this when I went to Tokyo. If you walk around Tokyo and go to a train station, what you'll see is this interesting pattern where when the train pulls into the station, the conductor will point at like a signal and say the signal is green, or they'll point at the speedometer and say the speedometer is 30 kilometers an hour. Outside on the platform, other employees are doing similar things. They're pointing up and down the platform and they'll say platform is clear. The cleaning staff, even as they walk onto the train in between sessions to clean it off, take the trash out and so on, they'll point at each car and, you know, say car is clean or trash is clear, things like that. And the purpose of this is that for anybody who does the same kind of job over and over again, like a train conductor pulling into the station, it becomes kind of automatic. It becomes habitual. And so it's very easy to overlook your mistakes. And so by pointing and calling, by literally physically pointing and saying out loud what you're doing, you're raising the level of awareness of the action. And you people don't use the phrase pointing and calling, but you can see them do this kind of thing all the time in daily life. So for example, I have a friend who, she'll leave the garage door up accidentally sometimes. And so now every time she pulls out of her garage, she points at the door and says, garage door is down. Or when you're getting ready to go on a trip or leave your house for a few days, you might double check everything and say, I have my keys, I have my glasses, I have my wallet. And you're like touching them in your pockets while you're doing that. And so those are all examples of pointing and calling to try to double check, to raise the awareness, to be aware, more aware of what we're doing. And if you want, you can actually use that same strategy when you're trying to build or break habits. So for example, if you want to stop snacking, when you reach into the cupboard to get out a cookie or go to the pantry to get out a snack, you could say, I'm about to eat this cookie and I don't want to, because I'm trying to stop snacking. And just the act of saying that out loud before you do it might be enough to prevent you from it. It sounds silly. It sounds a little like over the top to do it, but a very useful strategy early on so that you become more aware of your behavior.
I hope you found the compilation of value. And I hope some of these ideas will help you have a productive and fulfilling 2024. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Connecting the Dots. If you want to dig deeper into awareness, the first two episodes of Connecting the Dots were all about that. The first one was about internal self-awareness, and the second one was about external self-awareness. You might find that of value. Thank you for listening. And if you find this content of value, do take a moment and rate and review on Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, or wherever else you consume the content. It will make a big difference to us. To know more about my advisory work, you can visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Bye now.